Hi, this is Austin Hill. Hey, thanks for checking out this podcast from Austin Hill in the Morning. Now, you can hear our program live weekday morning, 6 till 8 Central Time. There are many more podcasts for this and all our Faith Radio shows. They're available online. Our web address, of course, myfaithradio.com. That's myfaithradio.com. And thanks for your gifts to this listener-supported ministry. Enjoy the podcast.
Start your day connecting faith to life. It's Austin Hill in the Morning.
Good morning, it's 6:04. Welcome to it, the Faith Radio Network. That's what you're listening to. And I'm Austin Hill. Thank you for being here. It's an honor to be with you weekday morning, 6 till 8. And as always, we appreciate your support of the Faith Radio Network. Always find us at myfaithradio.com. Now, coming up later this morning, we have got some, I want to call it news. We have some developments on the front of an American Christian pastor being held captive, and I would say illegally so, in the country of Iran. You probably have heard the story. We've talked a fair amount about it, even just earlier this week here on this program. Pastor Saeed Abedini, he is with the Calvary Chapel Church denomination, and he's from Boise, Idaho, of all places, kind of a remote place in the world. But nonetheless, what happened, and I'll tell you about this in about half an hour from now, there's been attention raised directly by the United States Secretary of State, John Kerry. And that is a big deal. That's very significant that Secretary Kerry would even utter Pastor Saeed Abedini's name, let alone state to members of Congress, hey, it is a goal of the Department of State to get him back home. And I have to believe that that's because there's millions of us around the country who are articulating to our government, this is what we want to see happen. But let's hope and pray this is a good development. We'll get to that coming up in, as I said, about half an hour from now. John and Kendra Smiley, popular speakers, authors, and parenting experts who travel the globe, quite literally, addressing issues of parents and kids and such. They will be with us later this morning, as they are regularly here on the Faith Radio Network on Wednesdays, be talking to us about kids who yell. We can make all kinds of fun little cliché jokes, I suppose, about using our inside voice and things of that sort. I have to say, I candidly, honestly, want to chuckle a little bit. But I've been there and done that as a father, as a parent myself. When you have problems with yelling that go way beyond the age where, you know, we talk about inside voices. We've got teens or preteens in the house that are sort of volatile, shall we say, with the tone with which they speak. This can be, and oftentimes it's a very serious problem. So John and Kendra Smiley joining us later this morning on parenting. And our great friend Bill English, founder and publisher of MindSharp, a tech firm. He also publishes BibleandBusiness.com. We're going to have some thoughts on our daily bread. What exactly is referenced in the Lord's Prayer when Jesus makes reference to our daily bread? We'll talk about that coming up later this morning. When we return, big news in the Middle East. And it seems as though there's some division, some uncertainty among Christians in the United States about how to deal with the assault on Israel and the sniping back and forth between Israel and the Palestinians. Again, an update on that hot spot in the world with our great friend, Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer. That's next. You're listening to the Faith Radio Network, and I'm Austin Hill at 6:07.
It's Austin Hill in the Morning.
Good morning, 6:08. Glad you're with us here on the Faith Radio Network, and thank you for listening. What is an appropriate American response, maybe even an appropriate American Christian response, to tensions in the nation of Israel? We'll talk about that coming up a little bit later. We have reports. And matter of fact, I'm going to get into this with our next guest here. We had officials in the government of Israel saying that with all the anti-Semitic sentiment, anti-Jewish sentiment around the world, especially in Europe and in the United States of America, and the ambivalence towards the assault on Israel, we have the makings of another Jewish Holocaust. And I suspect that's the case. That said, we have this ongoing military tension between the government and the country of Israel and this, for all intents and purposes, a terrorist group called Hamas. What are we to make of that? Joining us for the latest, our great friend, Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, retired from the United States Army. Lieutenant Colonel Schaefer serves with the Center for Advanced Defense Studies, a think tank in Washington, D.C. He joins us on the Newsline. Colonel Schaefer, welcome back to our program, and thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me on again, Austin. Good to be on.
Always good to speak with you. As you see it, how do you evaluate the latest details of, I guess, Israel versus Hamas right now?
Well, the thing for your audience to understand is that really this was prompted by Hamas. Hamas has been, as we've now found, building tunnels under the border, essentially setting up mechanisms for them to do sneak attacks against the Israelis. I understand that there was a larger attack planned for later this year where they would have actually gone about kidnapping Israeli civilians and military for purposes of terror. So what you've seen now is the Israelis pushing back, going into the Gaza Strip very hard militarily to both defend itself from these missiles. They've been firing missiles into the interior of the Israeli state, as well as prevent these tunnels from being used. So to me, Austin, it's very clear that the Israelis had every right to essentially take and do, I'll be very blunt, offensive operations, but for the purpose of defending their own nation. So I think it's very legitimate, and I'm not quite sure why they're, and I've seen, as you have, the debate on this here. To me, there's no debate. This is no different than had West Virginia decided it was going to attack Virginia, the great state of Virginia, and our governor here, using the Virginia National Guard to push back into West Virginia to stop the West Virginians from attacking us. I don't see any difference in the two analogies.
That is a very powerful analogy, and yet, Tony, you know better than the rest of us, I believe, that's actually a recurring theme in the broad discussion about this here in the United States. And we see the Prime Minister of Israel and other officials in that government state over and over again, as though they're speaking to a disbelieving audience, they say, hey, we have a right to exist. How seriously compromised is the right to exist of Israel, would you say? Can you evaluate that?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, the Israelis have been working with the Palestinians. You brought up the Palestinians. The Palestinian people are different than Hamas. The Palestinian people are different than Fatah, which essentially is underpinnings of the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. What you see here, Austin, is a terrorist organization, Hamas, who is organized around the objective of destroying the Israeli state. So, again, going back to my analogy of West Virginia versus Virginia, if West Virginia's primary purpose in life was to destroy Virginia, I think we'd have a problem here. We'd be fighting to survive. And that's what the Israelis are faced with here. And so what we've seen is an attempt by Fatah, by the Palestinian Authority, to kind of mitigate Hamas's really hard edge. They attempted to merge the two governments together, Hamas and Palestinian Authority. And there's actually they actually did that. Unfortunately, now that the two governments exist, Hamas is not even paying attention to its own government. It signed up to be part of the Palestinian Authority, and now it's not even listening to that. So basically what you have is a group, Hamas, who has gone rogue even from its own Palestinian governance. So what you see is the Israelis having no choice left but to go in and defend themselves and to do it in a very vigorous, very direct manner.
Is Israel seriously at risk for losing something, losing some modicum of sovereignty, losing some of its own territory that is a part of the nation of Israel? How serious is the threat on that country?
Well, you know, the threat of I don't see any territorial issues at this point. I mean, obviously there's been issues regarding the pieces that they obtained through both the 67 and 72 wars. But at this point, I think it's more about just protecting its people. I mean, again, part of what was going on here is you had the Muslim Brotherhood, and let me bring them into the picture. Muslim Brotherhood is an Egyptian organization, which essentially is all about a global caliphate that would see the Muslims run everything. And essentially, the Muslim Brotherhood was supporting Hamas, building itself up during the time that President Morsi, the now dethroned president of Egypt, was supporting it. That we saw literally tons and tons of concrete, weapons, all sorts of missiles moved into the Gaza Strip while the Egyptians were ruled by the Muslim Brotherhood. And now what we're seeing essentially is the end effects of that, of all the support that the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood had given them Which also, by the way, the side issue really does justify why we should declare the Brotherhood a terrorist organization like the Egyptians have. They have been supported by others in the region, and that's what the Israelis are trying to prevent now, is any more support coming from outside.
All right, Colonel Tony Schaefer, he's with the Center for Advanced Defense Studies. He's on our guest line. Tony, can you hold on for just another moment? I've got another quick question for you.
Sure. Absolutely.
All right, we'll continue in just a moment with Colonel Schaefer. You're listening to Austin Hill in the Morning at 6:15. This is the Faith Radio Network. Good morning. This is the Faith Radio Network, and I'm Austin Hill. Still to come, some big news on an American Christian pastor being held illegally in the country of Iran, Pastor Saeed Abedini. I will tell you about that. Also, some great parenting wisdom later this morning from John and Kendra Smiley on dealing with kids who have yelling issues. Raise your hand if you can relate to them. Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, he's with the Center for Advanced Defense Studies. He's on our guest line here on the Faith Radio Network, weighing in on matters surrounding the country of Israel. Tony, if we could take a step back here for just a moment. We've talked about the military attack on Israel and the sniping back and forth between Hamas and Israel and such. And I want to get your perspective, since you've traveled the world, not only as a public servant in our U.S. Army, an officer in our Army, serving our nation, but as a consultant, you're working on various projects, many of which really don't even get discussed publicly, as far as trying to help nations that are really struggling with collapsed governments. You've seen all of these things from a very distinct perspective. And we had earlier this week officials in the government of Israel saying that the anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish sentiment around the world, in Europe and in the United States, is so great right now that we've got the makings of another Jewish Holocaust. Now, I can imagine a lot of people here in the U.S. rolling their eyes and saying, well, that's just hyperbole, and that's, you know, that's just his perspective, and whatever, and we move on. How serious are we to take that when the Israeli government is saying that the ambivalence towards Jews, maybe even the hostility towards Jews, is so great, there could be another Holocaust? What does that mean to you?
Well, I think you're correct. There's been, I'd say, beyond ambivalence, I'd say essentially disdain for the Jewish state and their actions, and I think it's dangerous on two accounts. First, again, any nation under attack by a terrorist threat has the right to defend itself, and that should be the first, you know, issue, period. You know, if you're attacked, you have that right. But then there's a second layer of this religious, I'd say, furor for no reason. I mean, again, going back thousands of years, you've seen this time and time again. And what's most dangerous about it now is that, once again, ignorance is raising its head. There's been issues in the Ukraine. There's been issues in France and some other nations where, you know, there's been protests against the Jews. And again, there's just no basis for it. It's completely emotional. It's completely based in hate. And I would encourage your audience, I mean, obviously in their own hearts, to understand it. Look, while the Christians have a certain view of forgiveness, others do not. And we should always take the high ground on this. But, yes, there's an issue, and it's dangerous because this ignorance could lead to violence, and violence leads to other things. That's where I think we're at right now.
Very interesting. How does the conscientious Christian here in the United States, stateside, those of us who are not traveling the globe and observing these things firsthand, how do we, I guess in an informed way, Tony, pray about these matters? How do we live proactively so as to try to make a difference, in your view?
Well, pray for peace. I mean, this is a case where I think everybody agrees that denuclearization of the Gaza Strip is the most important thing to seek right now. And that's something even President Obama has basically stated. With that said, you know, we have our own issues here. And I think we should pray for guidance on how we're supposed to deal with the southwest border, which, by the way, we should probably talk about another time, which is very much a danger zone for us here in the United States. And bad things can come through there. So I think we need to focus on our own issues as well.
Well stated, as always. Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, he's with the Center for Advanced Defense Studies, a nonprofit think tank and consulting group in Washington, D.C., a veteran of our U.S. Army. Tony, we appreciate what you do. You're a guiding light and a voice of clarity and wisdom in very, very difficult times. Thanks for being here. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you.
Good to be with you. I appreciate that man very much and his clarity and not politicizing these things, but spelling them out and saying, here's where things are at, and here's the goodness and the badness mixed in. These are very, very difficult times. I don't know about you, but I struggle with weighing in on these things, and I prayerfully ask, God, what is it to be a conscientious, thoughtful servant to you in these very perplexing sort of times here in our nation? We are blessed to live in the United States of America. We still, our nation still has the most robust and most powerful military force in the world. And you and I, we have a voice in how that gets utilized, how that is harnessed, and what happens in this country. What's the right direction? What's the wrong direction? Very perplexing times. Pray for peace, as Colonel Schaefer admonished us, and I would encourage that we all pray that God gives each and every one of us discernment as far as what it means to be a responsible, thoughtful Christian and citizen of his kingdom, yes, but citizen of the United States of America at such a time as this. Speaking of the course of things and world events and such, we have some, I hope it's good news. I hope it's good news. I will just state it that way. Some positive developments on the front involving a gentleman named Saeed Abedini. And I'll tell you, I know people that actually are members of the church where Pastor Saeed Abedini served for a number of years. If that name to you, if you're just kind of, you've heard the name Saeed Abedini, S-A-E-E-D, by the way, is how you spell his first name. If you've heard that name before, but that just kind of sounds to you like, yeah, that guy's probably not from the United States of America. And I understand that sentiment. And by the way, Saeed would be the first person to address that and to be okay with you assuming that. He is a native of the country of Iran, actually, but he is a naturalized citizen. Came into the country when he was a very young child, after the fall of the Shah of Iran and the takeover by the Ayatollah Khomeini back in the late 1970s. I was in junior high school at the time. Saeed was, gosh, I think he was a fairly newborn guy when that was going on. His parents fled the country of Iran at that time, as did a lot of young Iranians in that era and in that generation. His parents managed to come into the United States. Saeed and his eventual wife, Nagmeh Abedini, they both fled the country of Iran to a freer, safer country called the United States of America. He became a Christian and went on to be called to the ministry with the Calvary Chapel Church. He is a pastor, still officially, with Calvary Chapel of Boise, Idaho, but he's being held captive in a very brutal prison in the country of Iran. I'll tell you what appears to be some positive movement on that front and some very hopeful signs. We'll get to that coming up. Also, John and Kendra Smiley joining us later this morning with parenting wisdom for all of us. All this just ahead. It's Austin Hill in the Morning on the Faith Radio Network. It's now 6:25. Good morning, and thank you for taking us along this morning here on the Faith Radio Network. Connecting Faith, you hear that weekdays at noon Central Time with Neil Stavem. And yesterday, Neil talked with Jerry Sitzer about finding joy and comfort in the midst of our pain and suffering. Here's part of that conversation from yesterday.
Jerry, in the book Grace Revealed, How God Reveals the Story, Redeems the Story of Your Life, you talk a fair amount about testing, but you also introduce the idea of training, you know, that we can, testing builds character, but training is another way to do it. It's sort of, you know, things happen to us, but we can have an influence on things as well. Talk a bit about training and character development.
Well, the argument I make is that the word for testing is a cognate for the word for character. So that character grows out of, or I should say doesn't automatically, but can grow out of various kinds of testing. My assumption there is that we, by nature, are relatively selfish people. Babies are not born with character. Character has to be cultivated in them over time. Babies might be cute, but they have no character. Character is formed when we're injured before the beginning of a junior high baseball season, and we were hoping to have a great season, and we have to sit out. Or when a second sibling is born into the home and we're displaced, or all those kinds of things. In other words, character is formed when we are somehow put to the test and reminded that we are not the center of the universe. Well, we all understand that. But in the history of Christianity, the other route to character, not mutually exclusive, by the way, is the route of training, that character can be cultivated by the formation of good and healthy habits, obviously directed toward the end of the glory of God and empowered by the Holy Spirit. So, for example, the quality, character quality of gratitude is something that can be cultivated. Every Sunday morning, when I get up early, in preparation for worship week and sometimes even larger than that, my life, and I simply spend time blessing God for the many gifts that he's given to me. Now, that isn't formed out of testing. It's a choice I make. So character cannot just emerge when we're put to the test. It can emerge as we cultivate habits that are pleasing to God. The habit, say, of generosity, stewardship, the habit of gratitude, the habit of service, so on. Those patterns, St. Augustine wrote a lot about the formation of these godly habits that are directed toward the end of the glory of God and obviously inspired by the work of the Holy Spirit.
Well, it seems that as you were talking about Augustine, you talk about some other early church fathers too that talked a lot about the present, that we really need to focus sort of in on the present. Maybe it goes back to, yeah. I guess, as you said, yeah. too, about getting into the middle of the story, not looking back at it.
Yeah, that's another good example of that is if you're trusting that God is in the story and that he'll redeem the past and that that the future is in his control, we can be present to the present. We can be fully awake and alive to what God is doing right now without being excessively distracted by regrets or concerning the past or worry about the future. We can be present to the moment. In fact, I'm going to say that probably has been the most meaningful, or I should say one of the most meaningful spiritual disciplines that I've tried to practice in the last 10 years is to be attentive to the present moment. Now, that doesn't mean that we live only for the moment. That's irresponsibility. But we should live fully in the moment as much as we possibly can, aware of what God is doing now, so we don't become distracted, as I said before, by the past.
Author Jerry Sitzer being interviewed on Connecting Faith with Neil Statham just yesterday, a fascinating conversation. Some deep things to think about, wouldn't you say? Coming up on today's edition of Connecting Faith with Neil Statham, Neil will talk with church planner and author Jim Belcher about his search for the roots of his Christian faith in Europe. Wow, there's a lot to contemplate, and especially at such a time as this. That's Connecting Faith, weekdays at noon, Central Time on Faith Radio. 6:31, you're listening to Austin Hill in the Morning. Thank you for being here. Our program continues in moments. The news is next.
Getting your day started, connecting faith to life. Back to Austin Hill in the Morning.
Good morning. It's 6:35 Central Time. Great to have you with us, and thank you very much for listening and for your support of the Faith Radio Network. You can find us anytime, all the time, at myfaithradio.com. The guests you hear on our program, we've got those interviews available in a click-to-listen or downloadable format, either one. It's our mobile-friendly website, myfaithradio.com. Coming up after the news at the top of the hour, our great friend Bill English will join us. Bill, of course, a noted entrepreneur, tech entrepreneur, but also the publisher of BibleandBusiness.com. We'll be dialoguing about what exactly Jesus was getting at and how does it apply to us today. What was Jesus getting at when he taught his disciples to pray and made reference to our daily bread? And this is, Bill's got some great thoughts on this. This is something that I've actually attempted to address. Not quite the way that I think Bill is going to approach it with us later this morning, but I've spoken about this on my weekend program, Austin Hill's Big World of Small Business, where we talk about entrepreneurship and work and the economy and making a living, and we try to see those things through the lenses of Scripture and through the lenses of our Christian faith. Consider this, before Bill comes in to our studios here a little bit later this morning, consider this. There is no biblical precedent. There is no biblical characterization of what you and I know as retirement. It doesn't exist. It's presupposed, and it's, I would say, pretty clear. Sometimes it's even explicitly stated in the Scriptures, but it is clearly, if nothing else, presupposed in the Old and New Testament that able-bodied individuals, those who are have the physical capacity to work and the mental capacities to do so, you work pretty much until you can work no longer. And then, after that, families take over. Grandma and grandpa move in with the kids and the grandkids and those kinds of things. And so this notion of retirement or a Social Security check or a pension or, you know, 401k, building up your nest egg and so forth, I'm not saying those things are wrong, by the way. I don't necessarily believe they are. But we have to navigate this terrain very, very carefully. And our daily bread doesn't necessarily imply or guarantee a nice big fat nest egg that you can just kind of kick back and say, phew, well, got the last 20 years taken care of, so now I can go play and go golfing or whatever. It's not that kind of thing. So anyway, Bill English, publisher of BibleandBusiness.com, joining us at 7:05 this morning. I do believe we have arranged for him to bring in, and I don't mean any disrespect here. I'm just having a little fun here. But I do believe he's going to bring in some daily bread for those of us in the studio to partake of. Probably, you know, baked goods with some little fun stuff sprinkled on top. Anyway, Bill English, BibleandBusiness.com, coming up at shortly after the news at 7 o'clock. And then later in the 7 o'clock hour, our great friends, the Smileys, they will jump in and they'll be offering some parenting advice for kids who have yelling problems. So that's all coming up into the second hour here on the Austin Hill in the Morning program. We have what I would like to think is some good news before us on the issue of a pastor, a Christian pastor here in the U.S. His name is Pastor Saeed Abedini. Now, I was talking a little bit about him before. This is a man who was actually brought into the United States. He eventually became a fully naturalized U.S. citizen. He is every bit as an American as I am. His origins, his a country of origin, I should say, is Iran. But his parents fled the country of Iran for a period of time back in the late 1970s when the Shah of Iran, that governmental figure, was toppled, and the Ayatollah Khomeini stepped into power. Now, our U.S. President Jimmy Carter was in the White House at that time, and that created all kinds of tension. You'll remember that Americans working at the U.S. Embassy in Iran at that time were taken hostage. It was a big mess. And I was in junior high school at that time, the sixth, seventh grade, something like that. Saeed Abedini was, my goodness, he was practically a newborn at that time, and literally was brought into the U.S., as far as I can tell chronologically, when he was a very, very, I mean, he was so young, he probably doesn't even remember that so much. But there are Iranian Americans living in the U.S. and abroad today. They are U.S. citizens, and just like the Abedini family did, the adult parents at that time, back in the late 70s and even into the early 80s, they fled that country, came to the United States in search of a better life, as so many other people have done. Same thing, by the way, holds true for a lady named Nagmeh Abedini. She's a native born of Iran and eventually met and married Saeed Abedini. They both still have family back in Iran, however. And as the story goes, just so everybody is up to speed on this, Pastor Saeed Abedini, he is a pastor on staff with the Calvary Chapel Church in Boise, Idaho. And as a part of his pastoral ministry, his pastoral outreach with Calvary Chapel, Saeed Abedini was seeking to establish an orphanage for abandoned children in the country of Iran. So back in 2012, Pastor Saeed Abedini travels to Iran, and he's putting together a board of directors and setting up a board of governance, if you will, for this orphanage. And the military police step in, and they arrest him. And it goes through a very lengthy, circuitous process, but basically he was sentenced to what the government of Iran is calling an 8-year prison term. And we are told that the prison is very, very brutal. It's a very dangerous place. And so this has touched off a chain reaction of Christians here in the U.S. who have been petitioning our U.S. governments and international forces to say, hey, this is a very serious human rights issue here. The idea of just arbitrarily rounding up this one guy and detaining him because he happens to be a Christian living in Iran, this is not respective of human rights. This is not fair, not by any definition that exists anywhere in the country, except maybe in the Muslim world itself. Well, for a frame of reference, for a little historical background, and Aaron, if we have the previous sound bites ready to go here, this is Nagme Abedini, the wife of the pastor. She's still back home in Boise, Idaho. And by the way, I know folks that belong to this church, this outlet of Calvary Chapel. And, you know, Saeed was the guy that went, you know, rafting in the summer with them and skiing in the winter. And, I mean, he was a guy that just worked alongside with everybody else. This is, I'm telling you this to try to convey, Saeed Abedini is not just this elusive figure whose photo is splashed all over the national TV news periodically. This is a regular guy in a regular middle America community, and he's been taken from his church and his family and his children and his neighbors. But that said, this is Nagme Abedini. Here she is describing how the word was getting around. This was about a year ago, and how it's really beneficial. The more we talk about it, the more we discuss this in our churches, it's really beneficial to her and the husband. Listen to this.
Despite what the Iranian government says, pressures and the media regarding Saeed and getting the word out is helping his situation.
All right. Now, this was Nagme Abedini was being interviewed right after some news had come out about Saeed, Pastor Saeed, having been beaten and tortured in his prison cell. Just real briefly, Aaron, roll that second cut. Notice what she says about his injuries.
They took him to a private hospital named Modares. He was taken back, and he still has the internal bleeding, and he has issues with his kidney.
All right. Well, just over the last couple of nights, Nagme Abedini and her attorney have been making some appearances on cable television networks here in the United States. We may be on the verge of a breakthrough, but this is still very worthy of our prayers and our proactivity. We'll talk about the very latest on this coming up in just moments. It's now 6:45. This is the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill. We're glad you're here. On the Faith Radio Network, I'm Austin Hill. John and Kendra Smiley joining us into the second hour of our program. Some parenting advice for those with children who have yelling issues. That's coming up in a little less than an hour from now, so stand by for that. Bill English with BibleAndBusiness.com. Some thoughts after the news at the top of the hour. Some thoughts on our daily bread. So the plight of Pastor Saeed Abedini, from Boise, Idaho, Christian pastor at Calvary Chapel Church. That plight may be improving somewhat. We just don't know, but this is a hopeful sign. The nonprofit group American Center for Law and Justice, ACLJ, the executive director of which, Jordan Sekulow, he was just on our program earlier this week, Monday, here on the Faith Radio Network. ACLJ reports that apparently Our Secretary of State, John Kerry, has addressed members of Congress and others working within the U.S. Department of State, and has said in essence, and I'm paraphrasing here, his remarks were kind of long-winded, as you might imagine, but I'm paraphrasing here, but he said in essence, it is a high priority of the Department of State to get this guy home. And this is in the midst. Jordan Sekulow spelled this out for us, actually, Monday here on our program. In fact, if you get over to our website, myfaithradio.com, you can find a text news story and the audio of my discussion with Jordan Sekulow. I encourage you to grab that, read it, listen to it, send it to friends. In a nutshell, Jordan Sekulow kind of got us all cut up on this. The discussions within the U.S. Department of State about Pastor Saeed Abedini are happening in the context of the United States and Iran kind of hashing out the details of what this new nuclear arms limitation treaty is going to amount to. You'll recall that back last December, President Obama made a diplomatic overture to the country of Iran, and the details of that agreement, whether you agree with it or not, whether you think it's a good idea or not, the details of that are still being hashed out. But here's this pastor, one of our own, sort of caught in the fray of this. Last night, and I believe that this, a new letter, a letter with some photographs sent from Pastor Saeed Abedini to his wife, Nagme Abedini, I believe this, along with a lot of prayer here in the U.S. and abroad, and a lot of Americans contacting the Department of State saying, please, we want this to be a priority. I believe this is kind of helping to turn the corner on things. This is Nagme Abedini. She was featured on the Fox News Channel last night. She was being asked about the photos that she has seen of her husband, the new photos, and the letter that she received from her husband. Now, this is in this first segment here. She's asked about the appearance of Saeed Abedini. Pastor Saeed conveyed to her that he said, gosh, I look at myself in the mirror and I don't even recognize me. My beard is so long, I'm so unkempt, and my hair is overgrown, and he's been beaten so severely, his eyes are swollen up, he's, I look in the mirror, and I don't know who I am. Here's the wife, if you can imagine how difficult this would be. The pastor's wife, Nagme Abedini, responding to questions about the photos and the letters. Listen to this.
It gave me a glimpse of what he's going through in that prison, and it was heart-wrenching to read that he couldn't recognize himself, and his mom's reaction, and so it just shows us the urgency of getting him out as soon as possible, and every day counts. Talking about his face is basically bruised and looks different, and he's got a beard, and yeah, it talks about his eyes being pretty beaten up and his face.
I think this is new information, and it's helpful information, but it is a matter of record that Pastor Saeed Abedini's parents, his mom in particular, she is living back in Tehran, in the capital city of Iran now. The parents fled back in the late 70s and early 80s, fled to the U.S., but they've returned to the country of Iran. And this is, I think, newsworthy here. Apparently, the pastor's mom, she's able to visit her son in prison on a regular basis, apparently once a week. Here's Mrs. Saeed Abedini, Nagme Abedini, explaining her mother-in-law's regular visits. Listen to this.
They see him every Monday, and they've there's up to now, there's still no medical treatment. He has not been transferred to a hospital. He hasn't been treated yet, and they're waiting for him. There was doctors that examined him, I believe last week, and they promised that they would take him to a private hospital outside of the prison to be treated, and that has not happened yet.
Yeah, this is, again, a very serious matter, and you can imagine how difficult that is for a wife, or a husband for that matter, to make that appearance in the scrutiny and the pressure of a national television interview describing the brutalization of their spouse. These are extraordinary circumstances. That said, the very fact that we now have the Department of State saying, hey, this is on our radar screen, this is very, very important, even in the midst of these international negotiations between the United States and Iran, this is, I believe, a very positive step forward. And I think, I believe, we should accept it as such, embrace it as such, shall we say, double down on praying about this situation. And there is a prayer vigil, national prayer vigil, being organized. You can get that information in my interview with Jordan Sekulow on our website at myfaithradio.com. But I want you to listen to this. Speaking of praying for Pastor Saeed, this is the pastor's son, Jordan Abedini. Somebody slipped into the bedroom and captured video of him as he was praying for his dad one night. Listen to this.
I love him and take good care of him and don't let him die and bring him home safe. And I love him so much. Amen.
Amen. If the young child can be compelled to pray like that, can't the rest of us? Get the info at myfaithradio.com. It's 6:53. This is the Faith Radio Network. Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill. How do we get through tough times? Author Philip Yancey has seen suffering firsthand. He joined Susie Larson on her program Live the Promise just yesterday to talk about his book, Where is God When It Hurts? Listen to this.
Well, when you consider Auschwitz or the Rwandan genocide or the tsunami in Japan, it seems like anything you'd try to say to speak of that would somehow trivialize the pain because it's the gravity of it is, you know, inexplicable. So is there anything to say? I mean, I would be so afraid to sound trite in any way in trying to figure that out. You know what I mean? What do you say in a situation like that? Because you've met people. You've traveled in these lands of suffering. What do you say?
That's right. That's right. Well, I wouldn't say this, but one behind-the-scenes thing is that you can't, that suffering is not a mathematical thing. For instance, I tell stories in this book. Some were based in the tsunami in Japan. Some were based in Newtown, Connecticut, where the school shooting took place at Sandy Hook. 20,000 people were killed in Japan. 20 children were killed at Sandy Hook. And you can't say, okay, 20,020, the suffering in Japan was 1,000 times or 10,000 times worse. It doesn't work like that. Suffering is suffering. All pain is pain. And it's actually one person at a time. So you've got 20,000 individual people who are feeling that pain, and you've got 20 individual people and their families who are feeling that pain. And that's how it hits us. So it doesn't really help much to try to compare my suffering to somebody else's. It usually makes me feel worse, you know. Maybe I have a broken leg and I hear my neighbor has cancer, so I think, well, I shouldn't be concerned about my broken leg because he's so much worse off. It doesn't work that way. Whatever you have, whether it's depression or something that seems small, is the very thing that is going to bring up the same questions as the tsunami and the big things. What would I say to those people? Well, you're right. I have been with them. The first thing I would say is if you feel confusion and grief and outrage, you're in good company because there's a lot of that in the Bible. All about two-thirds of the Psalms, most of the prophets, Lamentations, Habakkuk, the whole book of Job. It's okay to have that feeling that there's something wrong with this world. In fact, I would go further and say, if you feel upset about things that go on in this world, you can only imagine how God feels.
Yeah.
If you feel grief, if you feel rage, you can only imagine how God feels.
Fascinating discussion. Philip Yancey, author of Where is God When It Hurts? On Live the Promise with Susie Larson just yesterday. Now coming up on Susie's program this afternoon, Leslie Vernick joins her as they talk about conflict in relationships, how to work through it. Live the Promise in a new two-hour format, weekdays 3 till 5 with Susie Larson here on the Faith Radio Network. 6:58, I'm Austin Hill. Great to have you with us here on our morning program. Still to come, some great parenting advice. We'll talk about what to do with kids who yell. We'll get to that and also talk about our daily bread. All this and more just ahead. It's the Faith Radio Network. The news is next.
Start your day connecting faith to life. It's Austin Hill in the morning.
Beautiful day.
Good morning, 7:04, and welcome to it. Thank you for being here. It's the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill. I'm here weekday morning, 6 till 8, and we appreciate you listening. Parenting, even during the tough times. We don't shy away from the tough issues, I guess, at least not when we have the proper guests booked on the program. We'll talk about dealing with children who tend to yell. That's coming up at about 7:35 this morning with some great parenting experts. You know them well. We'll tell you about that coming up. Also, if you missed it last hour, I will do an update here on what I believe is some very positive developments in the plight of Christian pastor Saeed Abedini from here in the United States. Some good developments on that front. Keep praying. We'll tell you about that coming up later this morning, this hour here on Austin Hill in the Morning. When we return, let's talk about what the Scriptures mean for us when it makes reference to our daily bread. Are you having some of your daily bread right now, or have you already this morning? Are you going to work to try to earn and perhaps build up more of a nest egg of daily bread? That might be inconsistent with what the Scriptures originally intended us to understand. But our great friend Bill English, entrepreneur and publisher of BibleAndBusiness.com, he'll join us to talk about our daily bread. In fact, it appears as though he's brought some daily bread into the studio. Well, that's just very cool. We'll do that next at 7:05. This is the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill. You're listening to the Faith Radio Network. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your support of what we do here. Find us anytime on our mobile-friendly website, myfaithradio.com. What is the Scriptures communicating to us, the writers of both the Old and New Testament, when it makes reference to our daily bread? What exactly is daily bread? How is that to be understood in a biblical sort of way? We welcome back to the microphone a gentleman who's actually brought some daily baked goods, anyway, into the studio, our great friend Bill English from BibleAndBusiness.com. Great to see you again, and thanks for the goodies. This is bountiful. This is plentiful. This will bless the whole office, I'm quite sure. Thank you for this.
Well, you're welcome, and I'm sure that the fat grams and the preservatives and the additives and the sugar will be well received by the staff here at KTIS today.
And your purchase of them is stimulative for the economy. So
there you go.
That's all very good.
Yeah.
But seriously, on a more serious note, and we can have fun with this and love doing that. At your website, BibleAndBusiness.com, you are so skilled with digging into the Scriptures and really considering how the biblical truths apply to business and our need and our desire and our pursuit of making a living and these kinds of things. Where do you begin a discussion, Bill English, on this concept of our daily bread? We kind of just kind of rolls off the tongue. We take it for granted. It's in the Lord's Prayer. But where do you start as you begin to contemplate our daily bread?
You know, I start in Proverbs 30, verses 8 and 9, really, where it says, where the writer says, "Give me neither poverty nor riches, but give me only my daily bread. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I may have too much and disown you and say, 'Who is the Lord?' Or I may become poor and steal and so dishonor the name of God." When you're a business owner, one of the things that you're doing is trying to create wealth. You're trying to create profit. You're trying to maximize the profits and the income and the revenue of the company, as you well know. And yet there has to be a kind of a throttle or a governor here within us that the Holy Spirit just builds into us so that we don't really desire the riches. We don't desire to be poor, but we don't desire the riches either. And we just realize that whatever customers buy from us today, whatever sales we make today, that's our daily bread. And as a result, we can give that away. We can give away a good portion of our profits precisely because we know that it's just a daily thing. Wealth is a renewable resource, and God will bring to us the customers that He wants us to have for tomorrow.
Okay, now you're hitting on a whole plethora of very important issues. Bill English, by the way, with BibleAndBusiness.com. He's in studio with us here at the Faith Radio Network. This notion that somehow I don't need the riches.
You don't.
And your point's well taken. What do you say to the person? And you're out speaking all over the country and speaking in churches and at the same time consulting to businesses. When the person says, well, therefore, Bill English, possessing riches, possessing wealth, building up a nest egg, that's obviously wrong. I don't think that's the case. When you speak to the wisdom of the scriptures that tells us we don't need the riches, that does not necessarily imply that being a rich person is bad altogether. How do you address that?
Well, having riches is something that God gives you as an entrustment to be used to further the kingdom and his glory. And so I may be the steward of, I don't know, $20 billion from mm-hmm. God. But even though in the American sense it might be mine, in the Christian sense it belongs to God, and I am simply a steward of that which he has given to me. And I need to realize that no matter what form those riches take, they are eventually going to leave my hand at some point in the future, whether through sale, liquidation, bankruptcy, or death.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just better steward them the way that God wants me to and be willing to hold them with an open hand, be willing to give it away if that's what God wants me to do.
Yeah, very English. Very interesting. Bill English with BibleandBusiness.com. You said it in English, too. That was impressive.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? Yeah.
It's good. He said with BibleandBusiness.com. On the issue of, and you're referencing this, of course, in the context of business owners, but this is something you and I have talked about personally, and we got into this last week when you were here on our program, Bill, and that is the notion that there really is no scriptural or biblical precedent or biblical foundation for this concept that we kind of glibly talk about here in the U.S., and that is retirement.
Yeah. I mean,
it's just expected. Yeah. In the Old and New Testament, it's implied, and at times it's explicit, that one works until they can no longer work, and then family steps in and takes care of grandma and grandpa or what have you until that individual passes on. Can this notion of riches that you're getting at, and some of the frailties and vulnerabilities of possessing riches, can this sort of become problematic in the sense that maybe some of us are maybe leaning a little bit too much on the nest egg or the nest egg that we desire to retire to? In other words, we don't think of it as I'm the rich young ruler building up riches, but by golly, I better have more and more and more added to my pension from my employer or whatever it is, or things are just not going to be right in the world. What do you make of that? Do the principles, the vulnerabilities, the difficulties, the challenges of riches apply to retirement pensions?
And they're very deceptive. Because
because
riches are fleeting, the Bible says. And look, in my personal experience, I have been in a position where I was swimming in cash. I had so much money, I didn't know what to do with it. And I've also been at the other end where I literally did not know how we were going to buy even food for dinner that evening. And so I understand what it's like to be in both situations. Look, depending on riches is deceptive precisely because they are temporary, they are fleeting, and they are something that is here today and gone tomorrow. God tells us to depend on him, and he will provide for our needs.
Bill English, publisher of BibleandBusiness.com. He's with us in studio as we talk about our daily bread. Now, we'll continue with Bill in just a few moments. His website, by the way, just chock full of great ideas and great wisdom. And again, Bill, not only a very successful entrepreneur, but I would remind you, he holds an MDiv, Master of Divinity degree, from a noted theological seminary. He is a theologian, I would say, in every sense of the world, and sort of marries the theology to business and economic matters. I like it. We'll continue with Bill, and we'll tell you more about the daily bread that he brought into the studio today. That and more just ahead. It's Austin Hill in the morning. You're listening to the Faith Radio Network. It's 7:15.
Back to Austin Hill in the morning. Questions or comments for the show? You can leave them on our show page at myfaithradio.com.
7:16. Thank you for being here on the Faith Radio Network. Coming up In just about 20 minutes from now, John and Kendra Smiley, parenting experts, worldwide parenting experts, talking to us about what to do with children who yell, yelling issues in the home. We'll get to that coming up in just about 20 minutes. Bill English, entrepreneur, CEO of MindSharp. He's also the publisher of BibleandBusiness.com. He's in studio with us as we talk about our daily bread, the biblical concept of our daily bread. And Bill, I want to ask you, what do you say to the person or maybe about the person who has accumulated a lot of wealth? They are a person of means, shall we say. They've got lots of money, and they need to be good stewards of it, as you said earlier. What do you say about the possession of large sums of money?
Well, what I say is that a couple of things. First of all, they should hold it with an open hand and be stewarding it before the Lord, ready to use it the way the Lord wants them to. On a personal level, they shouldn't strive to live at the highest level of standard that they could. What I like to see business owners do, and frankly, this is a great way to figure out how to pay your pastor too, by the way.
Which is a whole other topic that we should address another time. But
yeah, actually, it's the same exact conversation.
You go to the
city that you live in, and you go to the Census Bureau and find out what the average salary is there, and what the average home prices is, and that kind of stuff. And you live at that level. You just live at that level. In that way, you are not living, you're kind of living out a little bit that give me neither poverty nor riches element within Proverbs. Now, what you don't do is you say, well, the city I happen to live in is the one I'm moving to, and that's the 90210 zip code, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you actually take the particular place that you're in right now, and you say, that's where God has me, and if he moves me, that's fine. But I'm not going to upscale just because I can.
Right.
Instead, I live where I'm at, and if God gives me an abundance of resources, then actually they're there to further the kingdom and potentially further the community too.
You know, on the issue of what to pay the pastor and how do you set that and calibrate that, and many years ago, I was, this is probably over 20 years ago now, my wife and I belonged to a particular church, and I wasn't on the elder board, but I was sort of on this advisory committee that was gathering input and data and advising the elders and such. And there was this investigation being launched. Well, is our pastor living, you know, too high on the hog, and is he, are we paying him too much? And gosh, the car that he's driving seems to be a little too fancy, and his clothes are a little too. And my wife and I ended up eventually leaving the church over that and a whole bunch of other issues. But I remember I was kind of caught off guard by a lot of this, you know, this inquisition of the pastor kind of stuff. It was very disturbing to me, the way our pastor, who I loved and appreciated very much, the way he was being treated. But I remember one gentleman on the board of elders, who really was a voice of reason at that time, said, wait a minute, let's kind of took the approach that you're describing, Bill English. Let's figure out what kind of the median lifestyle, median income is in our area. But also, he raised this issue. What is appropriate for our pastor's station in life? The kinds of circles that he moves in, the kinds of people that he is ministering to, he needs to fit in on some level. We don't want him being among the wealthiest. We don't want him so impoverished or living such a low financial lifestyle, shall we say, that he doesn't fit into the very community that he's trying to minister to. There is a sense in which we need to fit in order to be effective, even for ministerial purposes, or at least so it would seem to me. What are your thoughts on that as a business person and as a person given to ministry?
I just don't see how that's any different for pastors and those who are not in the pastorate. I think it's the exact same discussion. Everything you've just said right there, Austin, about pastors, could be applied to business owners, it could be applied to employees, it could be applied to everybody. But this is something that you do not force on people from the external. It has to come from the Holy Spirit leading them, and only those who are really walking well with the Lord are going to be sensitive enough to be willing to give up a significant portion of their wealth, because they know that they have something greater, and that is the person of Jesus Christ in their life.
Mm-hmm. Bill English, publisher of BibleandBusiness.com. He's in studio with us here on the Faith Radio Network. address this, if you would, for me. As a person
sure.
who's been to great heights and you've had businesses win, you've had them lose.
Sure.
You're a theologian.
Yep.
What do you say on the issue of, I'll describe it this way. I believe we live, especially right now here in the U.S., but worldwide, we live in a culture of envy. We live in a culture that is predisposed to not liking those who are monetarily successful. And, I mean, we're surrounded by rhetoric that says, well, the rich people aren't, quote unquote, paying their fair share, whatever that means. The rich people need to exercise and live out austerity. The rich people are to blame for my lack of success or what have you. I get very unnerved, very fearful of a society that becomes too envious and jealous, I guess, of the wealthy people within it. What do you say about that?
Well, there's two sides to that coin. One is those who are jealous should not be jealous because God simply hasn't entrusted them with the same amount of wealth that he's entrusted other people. But secondly, there's a whole lot of rich people who spend a whole lot of money on themselves needlessly when they can instead be using that, in my estimation, in kingdom more productive ways than what they do. Now, look, I get the whole laissez-faire thing. I get the whole capitalism when a rich person rents a hotel room for $1,000 a night, they're helping to generate jobs that don't pay nearly as much. I get that whole thing. I get the whole thing. My thing is that if the rich came off as being people who are givers rather than grudgingly being willing to be taxed,
mm-hmm.
I think it would be different. And frankly, I think if the politicians would stop pitting groups, economic groups against each other for the sake of political gain, that would do a whole lot to help our country heal. What we don't need are leaders who say the rich is bad and the poor are good, or the middle class is really where it's at, or however they want to say it. I'm really sick of politicians leveraging the emotions and the envy of people in order to get votes and to gain political power.
Bill English, check him out at BibleAndBusiness.com. Some great wisdom there. That's BibleAndBusiness.com. Bill, as always, great to see you. Thanks so much. Thanks for bringing some bread products in as we talk about our daily bread.
Well, you're welcome.
And we'll look forward to seeing you again soon. Have a great day. 7:25, you're listening to the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill. What is the one issue? The one issue that Christians, at least in the United States, Christians don't want to talk about. What is that one issue? We'll tell you what that one issue is coming up next. Don't go away. Good morning, 7:35 on the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill, and thank you for being here. I'm here weekday morning, 6 till 8. We appreciate you listening. We appreciate your support of the Faith Radio Network. Find us anytime at myfaithradio.com. That's our mobile-friendly website, myfaithradio.com. One thing we've got posted there that I need to draw your attention to right now is actually a great piece written by John and Kendra Smiley, popular speakers, international parenting mentors. They join us now to talk about their very latest piece entitled, I Can't Hear You When You're Yelling. What do we do with families that have yelling going on? John and Kendra, welcome back to the program. Thank you so much for joining us once again. Where do we start on this issue of yelling? Not only the kids yelling, but moms and dads of teenagers yelling at the kids. Where do we begin that conversation?
Well, it's interesting. I guess I want to begin with a kind of a goofy family story. We live on a farm, and our kids were raised on a farm. And you know, you can be loud. All of you can be loud, even when you're having fun or, you know, not necessarily because you're angry about anything. And so our kids grew up, and our oldest son was raising his family, he and his wife. And I heard him one time say, they, of course, raise their kids now in town.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard him one time say to his oldest child, no, honey, here you need to use your outside voice. And I realized that they were louder inside than when they went outside. Where there were neighbors, they had learned to talk a little more softly. But that's not typically the way it goes. What we want to talk about today really isn't the voice volume of the kids,
mm-hmm.
but the fact that there are a lot of parents that are yelling at their children to change their children's behavior. And it's showing that it's not making a difference.
Well, one of the issues that you both address in this latest blog post, I'll call it, on our website, myfaithradio.com, is that the yelling at the kids is oftentimes a behavior aimed at teenagers. And I got to tell you, I mean, I'm the parent of a teenage son. My wife and I are raising a teenage son. And there's times when seemingly speaking in a normal tone of voice or an inside voice, if you will, it's just not getting through. John, you're already chuckling here. I think you've heard this before, haven't you?
Right, and I think basically if most of the time we're dealing with a normal tone of voice and then we raise our voice, it does have effect, just like you said, with a teenager or with younger kids. And I think basically what we're trying to talk about here, so much of the time in parenting today, tools are being taken out of the toolbox and parents are left with things that they think might help. And probably one of the biggest things that brings on yelling, screaming, this type of thing is the controversy over spanking. And parents don't think they can spank anymore, so they've got to find alternatives. And one of the things that we've found is they start screaming at their kids, and whether it be younger kids or older kids, and that's not the occasional raising your voice, but this is one of those things that becomes a habit and is used all the time. And they scream at kids because they don't think they have anything else in the toolbox that works. And then the kids just basically tune them out.
And, of course, we're talking about spanking when the child is young, not, you know, definitely not when they even have
right.
one toe into puberty. It was really interesting. There was a study done at Brown University,
mm-hmm.
and it suggests that yelling at kids had more negative consequences than spanking. Because if there was a warm relationship with the parents and that was a consequence that was delivered, it was understood. However, if there was a warm relationship and there was yelling, it kind of negated the fact that there was a warm relationship.
That's very interesting. John and Kendra Smiley on our guest line here on the Faith Radio Network as we talk about yelling between parents and children. I note in what you two have written here, you point out that yelling or raising one's voice is not necessarily a form of abuse. It can simply be a way to draw attention to a problem or a situation. Is that to say that there are times when it is appropriate for a parent to raise their voice to yell at a child?
Absolutely. The first one that comes to my mind is when the child starts to go out on the road. You definitely need to raise your voice. The key is, if I have been yelling all the time, it doesn't really resonate when I say, don't go out in the road, there's a car. And so it's important that we have a normal voice. But if I want to draw attention to something that's going on, absolutely. And there are some rules, too, with raising your voice. You know, are you yelling and making it a personal attack? That's never proper.
Right, and I think probably what happens usually in parenting is it's the frustration of the parent
right.
that
yep.
brings on the screaming, the yelling, and yes, because the actions of the child, but the frustration of the parent is coming out. And so when parents get frustrated like that, and a lot of times when parents are yelling and screaming, they're out of control. And one of the things that we say, the parent should be in control. If the parent is out of control, lots of times the child is in control, and we don't want that. We want parents to be in control of the situation.
Right. Kids aren't qualified at that point in life.
Yeah, no, I hear what you're saying. It also seems to me like there's some scriptural nugget of wisdom here, in as much as our motivation for yelling, like so many other kinds of activities that the scripture describes, the motivation of the heart really does matter here. You're saying that on the one hand, Kendra, if we're yelling because we need to express to our teenager, for example, hey, there's danger out here, take this seriously, that's why I'm raising my voice, that's perhaps a more healthy, more righteous motivation, so to speak. But if I'm yelling because I'm just exasperated and I'm out of control, John, that's not such a good thing. Is that kind of an appropriate way to understand this?
Yeah, I think that's very well said. And I think the other thing that happens, which I have actually witnessed in a parent doing with a child, then and that parent starts screaming, they're out of control. And what I witnessed was it goes from screaming, and then it moved into name-calling. And so we just elevate this situation. And again, this parent that I that I witnessed was totally out of control, and they didn't know how to tone that down. And the next thing I knew and I heard was this parent calling their kids names. And I'm thinking, oh, my goodness,
yeah.
You know, this thing has been elevated to the point of calling the child names instead of just raising the voice, because they knew that the screaming at the child wasn't having any effect on this child. And they thought, oh, boy, you know, how can I raise this up another level? They raised it up another level and started calling the child names. And as you might expect, that didn't have any effect either. That had very much a negative effect on that child.
You know, you both note in your latest piece on this issue that as a form of behavior modification, yelling at our children is largely unsuccessful. It's sometimes perhaps appropriate, maybe even necessary, but it usually doesn't produce the desired outcome that we want. Comment on that if you would, please.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, and why are we yelling? I think John made a very good point. We're usually yelling because we're at the end of our rope. And, why are people yelling maybe more than your parents yelled, my parents yelled a generation ago or two? Because people are trying to avoid spanking because it's sort of been vilified, and abuse is definitely needs to be vilified. But if there's a consequence that's delivered because of love and it is spanking, that's really more effective and less harmful to the child's psyche, as so says Brown University, than people screaming.
Right, and the behavior modification part of it, when we talked a little bit about before, if you occasionally raise your voice when a child is in danger, you definitely get their attention, and then they look back on that and they realize, huh, I know now why my mom and dad raised their voice, because there was danger there. And if as just a habit, a parent is continually raising their voice as a child, what the child does is they evaluate that and they say there's nothing there of danger, destruction, or defiance. And so then, just like anything else, as an adult, we do this, and children do this. They just tune it out.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's no change of behavior in that instance because mom and dad are raising their voice. Oh, they do that all the time. They scream at me all the time. There's really nothing to change here. And it's almost like hearing a sound in the distance, and your ears adapt to that, and kids adapt to that screaming, and it doesn't do anything. They just say, well, that's just the way mom and dad are. And so we definitely, as parents, don't want to get into that mode of our kids just tuning us out.
Yeah. All right. Now, when we come back, I want to ask both of you about avoiding this condition where our kids are just tuning us out. The louder we get, the more they tune out. And for the parent who's listening to our conversation, say, okay, I don't like this feeling of being out of control. I don't like the way I react. I don't feel good about myself when I yell at my kids coming from that place of being out of control. But what's the alternative? They're not hearing when I speak in a normal tone of voice. I'm not getting through. What's the alternative? We'll get some steps from John and Kendra Smiley on what is the appropriate, more productive approach to these dilemmas when we continue. John and Kendra Smiley, international speakers who minister to parents all over the world. Their latest piece, I Can't Hear You When You're Yelling. What's the alternative? We'll get to that coming up next. 7:45, you're listening to the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill. We're glad you're with us. On the Faith Radio Network, I'm Austin Hill. John and Kendra Smiley are with us every week. They speak to parents literally all over the world. They are full of wisdom. Their very latest piece that we have published at MyFaithRadio.com entitled, I Can't Hear You When You're Yelling. Let's talk about the alternatives, John and Kendra Smiley. You've got us hooked. You've got, I'm sure, plenty of us convicted that, hey, I you know, when I do raise my voice at my child, it's oftentimes because I do feel out of control. I don't know any other alternative. There's got to be a better way. What is that better way? Where do we start with that?
I think the first thing is being aware that that's kind of the default mode. You know, you go to yelling, and if you say, aha, what I've been listening to, that's me. How did they know this? The first thing, you've taken the first step. Okay, you've identified that this is something that happens. So then take a step back and try to think, what are the things that lead up to this? You know, are there any, does your blood pressure rise? You know, do you start to perspire? Whatever it may be, what's leading up to this meltdown? And when you realize that's it, then as soon as you start to feel that tendency to move in that direction, give yourself a timeout, right? Whatever it is, as long as there's no one in danger, you know, step back from the frustrating situation, whisper a prayer, ask the Lord to help, give you peace, help you be in control, and just that moment away can be a calming effect.
Right, and I think probably a little bit before that is mom and dad sitting down and working together on, like, boundaries. What are we as parents going to allow and not allow? I think a lot of times we get into the yelling thing because mom and dad haven't done that. Or if it's a single parent, just mom or dad. Okay, mm-hmm. This is what I'm going to allow. This is what I'm not going to allow. Why do we scream? Why do we want to change a behavior? And that is because if the child is doing something destructive or defiant or dangerous. And so if we can start looking at these things, and then I would make this point, that one of the ways that we can keep from screaming is the confidence we have as parents. Parents need confidence in their parenting. And if we are a confident parent, we can talk to that child. We can take a look at what we're doing and come up with the consequences for crossing over a boundary that we've set. Usually parents that scream don't have that much confidence. And like Kendra said right at the beginning, they get frustrated. And frustration comes from a lack of confidence. So we want to take a look at resources to get confidence, other people, the Bible, just the power the Lord can give us, that we have confidence as a parent to know the boundaries we are setting are good boundaries, and then we are upholding those boundaries with adequate consequences.
You know, on a real practical note, probably the thing that used to frustrate me more than anything was actually my own behavior, which was not allowing enough time for the boys to get ready for wherever we were going to go. When I realized that, I just made a real practical, not always pleasant in my own book, because sometimes I wanted to stay in bed myself a little longer, but I made a change. And that was, okay, I need to get up a little earlier because I'm not giving them enough time. So giving your kids just not, you know, not commanding them, you have to do it now, when they really haven't had enough time. Remember, these are kids we're talking about. So we want to keep the expectations realistic.
Right. And one other thing, especially if you're dealing with teenagers, older kids, mm-hmm. and that is sitting down, talking to them, having them buy in, and the realization of why you're setting the boundaries for them and what those boundaries are about. Now, they may not agree with them all the time, but at least you're looking at them together, and they know why you're doing that. And again, I think that keeps the frustration level of parenting down.
John and Kendra Smiley, they are full of wisdom. We're talking about parents who yell and yelling between parents and children. Real quick here, we had somebody call in, and they wanted me to pose a question to both of you, and I'll augment the question just a little bit. The question was, do you believe that Jesus were to have been the case that he was a father, a biological father with offspring, would Jesus spank his children? And I would add to that question, would Jesus yell at his children? How would each of you respond to that?
Well, I think Jesus would make sure that they knew what the boundaries were and that he would have adequate consequences for the boundaries. That would be my reply.
Right, and he would be in control, I believe. And I think we see this in the Bible, throughout the Bible, and there are very specific places that it talks about the parent being in control and not being in control. So whether Jesus spanked or whether Jesus didn't spank, I don't think that's the question. I think the question is, would Jesus be the perfect parent? Would he be in control? And I believe the answer to that is yes.
Is there ever, using the life of Jesus and the fact that he, you know, overturned the tables in the temple, we saw that tremendous expression of anger and outrage at the injustice of the temple being monopolized and commercialized, if you will. Is there ever an appropriate time and place where we express our anger to our kids, with or without raising our voice?
I think there definitely may be. The whole thing, why did Jesus do that? It was motivated by love. It was motivated by love and what was right. And so, yeah, there are times probably when it would be very appropriate.
Right, and I do believe that Jesus was totally in control when he did that. And that's a huge thing with parenting. Like Kendra said right from the beginning, most of the time it happens when parents are out of control. Parent is in control, making a good decision, like that child running out on the road, And definitely, definitely, it's a time to raise your voice.
All right. Now, I have to ask a question that I don't want this to get in between you two. And I ask it kind of tongue-in-cheek. She's already laughing. All the content here seems to be posted on Kendra's website. John, are you sharing the burden of the heavy lifting of the posting and such?
No. I leave that to Kendra. I just Kendra and I talk about things, and then I don't even have a smartphone. I still have a flip phone. So Kendra's our techie, and she does all that good stuff.
Yeah, he flew multi-engine jets for 30 years, and he has a dumb phone. What I like to say is that we work together. John is the brains, and I'm the voice.
Well, we love you guys. We appreciate what you do. You can find this latest editorial that they've co-authored, at least I presume they have, on myfaithradio.com. And more information is at kendrasmiley.com, spelled just like it sounds. We've got links to that. Thanks, you two. Appreciate that. We'll let you get back to the labor of the farm, and we'll look forward to talking again next week.
Thank you.
All right.
Good to be with you both. John and Kendra Smiley, great wisdom for parents who are frustrated with yelling in their household. All those in favor say aye. Yeah, I'm with you. 7:55, you're listening to the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill. Thank you for being here. Thank you for that music. Aaron McIntyre on the other side of the glass booth. 7:55 on the Faith Radio Network. And thank you for listening. I'm Austin Hill. I'm here weekday morning 6 till 8. By the way, just a little note here. For whatever it's worth, I'm not saying this to prove a point. I guess I am kind of saying this to prove a point. But John and Kendra Smiley were just with us in the previous segment. And Kendra made reference to the fact that, she said, you know, my husband doesn't even have a smartphone. He's not a real techie kind of guy. In fact, John Smiley himself acknowledged that, and Kendra said he has a dumb phone. And just a little anecdote as you go off and do what you're going to do today. So often we'll kind of juxtapose. We'll try to figure out what does get juxtaposed as an opposite, if you will, of the term smartphone. The word or the term smartphone is just so much a part of our culture. You know, it's an iPhone, an Android, does all these really super cool things. I get a little uncomfortable with the term smartphone because smart is an attribute that that we apply to animate objects. In other words, human beings or even animals in some cases. Those are, you know, human beings, animals, those are part of God's creation. Inanimate objects like telephones or computers or whatever, they don't possess intelligence. They aren't smart in the way that God's creation can be smart. Just a little philosophical thing that floats around in my cranium when I hear that term smartphone. But Kendra was just having some fun. I was having fun with both of them, and she juxtaposed the term smartphone and dumb phone. By industry standards, and if you work in the mobile phone industry, mobile telecom industry, you know that you don't have people come into the store and say, well, here's our lineup of dumb phones over here in the corner. No, that's not the industry term. The industry term is feature phone. Feature phone. If it's not a really super cool smartphone, well, we wouldn't want anybody to feel, you know, bad about just buying a phone or being issued a phone or what have you. It's a feature phone. Just wanted to clarify that as we were having some fun with John and Kendra Smiley. Make sure to get to myfaithradio.com, by the way, and see their latest post. I just love what those folks do so much. They are so full of wisdom. Coming up on tomorrow's program, relationship expert Lisa Vernick will join us to share 10 things to know about marriage. We'll also talk with Dr. Richard Land of the Southern Evangelical Seminary. He'll join us to talk about culture and marriage here in the United States as it pertains to the younger generation. Thank you for listening. Find us at myfaithradio.com. I'm Austin Hill. Have a great day. We'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to this podcast from Austin Hill in the Morning. For more information about this, you can visit Austin Hill in the Morning, our program page, on MyFaithRadio.com. That's MyFaithRadio.com.